Welcome to What the SFF, an Angry Robot podcast. My name is Sam McQueen. I am the editorial and publicity assistant at Angry Robot Books, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to another episode of the podcast, this time featuring two Angry Robot authors, one of whom has just released their debut novel with us, and the other whose book we will be delighted to be releasing slightly later in the year. I will first of all get our authors to introduce themselves. So, Rob, if you would first like to tell us a little bit about The Light Years.
Hi, Sam. Hi, listeners. My name is Rob Green, but I write as RWW Green because it's easier to Google. My debut just came out February 11th. It's called The Light Years through our wonderful Angry Robot Books. I'm terrible at this what it's about question. It's the captain of a family trader ship organizes an arranged marriage for her son in hopes of achieving faster than light travel and possibly everlasting love. That's my elevator pitch.
Which I think you've done a great job of distilling, as you say, a quite kind of complex, multi-threaded and very fun narrative down to a couple of sentences. So well done. You can tell you've been doing launch events recently. You're good
at summing it up. Yes, I have. Yeah. So thank you very much for that vote of confidence.
No problem at all. And next we have Ginger, whose debut book, The Rush's Edge, we are releasing slightly later this year. Ginger, would you like to say hello and tell us a little bit about your book?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ginger Smith, and like Sam said, I wrote The Rush's Edge. It's the story of a genetically engineered, lab-grown, and tech-implanted soldier who salvages technology with his best friend and former commanding officer. They salvage technology on the edge, and they run across a strange artifact that actually downloads something into their ship, and they end up kind of running from the government and getting involved in a, I guess you'd call it kind of like a rebellion. Gosh, it's so hard to summarize. I have a lot more notes than that, but that's pretty much the summary.
That sounds really good.
I mean, as we said, once you get to the point of launching the book, you'll have that down pat. But that's a pretty good summation to be this far away from when we're actually releasing the thing. Okay. It's out in October,
yes,
isn't it?
October 13th, I believe.
You're just going through, have you just finished a round of edits? Is that right?
I'm about to start the round of edits. So I am I'm pretty early in the process. So that's probably, I'm sure I will polish up that pitch and have it going well by then.
Well, it's kind of fun, Ginger. What I've noticed, like, you know, since I've launched and I've been doing these events is by talking about the book now, I feel like I understand it. I finally understand what it's about. So now, you know, I wrote it, you know, back in, you know, 2015, and I was where you were, you know, back in the fall and this kind of stuff. But now that I'm finally out and kind of talking about it and answering questions about it, it's only now that I'm finally figuring out what the hell it is that I wrote.
Right. It's hard to take a you know, 200 or 300 pages and condense them down into two sentences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the jobs that often falls across my desk is back cover copy. So bad enough having to take your own work and then, you know, taking it down to like that one page pitch letter, but then to take that and, you know, reduce it to those few sentences that you have to grab someone's attention when it's on the shelf or that browsing experience. So that is a hard thing to do, whether you're the author or whether you're the publisher. But that is an excellent segue into my first question. So both your books were published through or acquired and published through Angry Robot's open submissions process. So some of our listeners might know that in addition to accepting submissions from agents, which is the way you know, the vast majority of publishers find the books that they will publish, we also run an open submissions process whereby authors who do not have an agent are able to directly submit their manuscripts to us, and that's usually by, you know, giving us a little brief summary of the book to try and grab your attention and maybe the first couple of chapters, and if we like what we read, then we might call in the full manuscript, and from that place you can get to a point where your book is published, which is a thing that we love doing because it allows us to find writers who are maybe coming from a slightly different part of the publishing landscape. And it's a testament to the kind of amazing books that you can pick up that both of you guys have been, you know, picked through that. And one of you is published, the other will soon be published. So do you want to tell us a little bit about kind of what that process was like and maybe what led up to both of you, say, submitting to Angry Robot? Were we the first publisher you'd submitted to? Had you been working on those manuscripts for a long time before Angry Robot was the place you gave them to? Or was it a different kind of process?
I was trying to remember exactly. I think the open submission period that I submitted to was November 2017. It was not Angry Robot was not the first place I had submitted to. I'd started, you know, doing kind of an agent hunt kind of thing, and I had submitted it to a couple of agents, and you know, got a mixed interest. And I think I was going through a very busy time, and I needed to kind of keep the book out there working for me. And I saw the Angry Robot kind of all call, and not having an agent at that time, I decided to submit. And that was right when you guys were about to move from Nottingham to London.
Right.
So the process was probably not as finessed as it is now. So you were asking, Angry Robot was asking for everybody to submit the entire thing. So I submitted the entire book. And then, you know, it 444 days passed before I got an email from...
A year and a half
wow. passed before I got an email from one of y'all saying, hey, is the book still available? And I said, yes. Kind of the interesting thing for me is that I was kind of keeping track on, because I'm part of Duotrope, which is a kind of a submission aggregator, and you can kind of log your submissions, keep track of your submissions, and it gives you data on your submissions. And I'm also part of this this online group called Absolute Right. So I was kind of able to keep track of the process through that. And I was watching like the numbers get smaller and smaller and smaller until it was down to like a couple of writers hadn't reported back that they had heard. And it turned out that I was one of them.
So you mean you were keeping track with other writers who had
submitted the same thing? I mean, right. You are talked about. Angry Robot is talked about. And, you know, writers like to talk to each other. So there was a whole forum on Absolute Right about like the, you know, the 2017 Angry Robot open submission period. And everybody who, you know, not everybody, but, you know, a large number of people who had submitted, they, you know, chimed in on this forum saying, hey, I submitted and this is what I submitted. And eventually everybody was like tapping out saying, oh, I just got my rejection, or, you know, so I was able to kind of keep track of what was going on that way. But also on Duotrope, because you can keep track of your submissions there too, and it keeps track of the submissions that are still out there. So I was watching that number click down from like, you know, 300 or 1500 or whatever it was, to slowly but surely getting down to that that just a couple, which either meant a good thing for me or it meant that you lost my submission. So you did not. Say bon.
Fantastic. Well, good things come to those who wait.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And how about you, Ginger? What was the kind of lead up to your publication journey, shall we say?
For me, I guess things happened a little faster. I finished the first draft of The Rush's Edge in March of last year, and I started submitting, and I'd submitted to several agents, and of course I got rejected like most first-time authors do. And then I saw, you know, something come up on one of the I get emails from different places about people, you know, who have submissions open. And so I said, well, you know what? I've got nothing to lose. The agent thing doesn't seem to be working that great. So I said, let me submit it and just see what happens. And I started reading about Angry Robot, and I said, wow, this is a really cool company. Like, they're cutting edge, outside of the box type of publisher. And I told my husband, I really wish I could get in with Angry Robot. That would be great. And so I submitted it, and you guys came back, I want to say like 2 or 3 months later. And then, I was so excited. Like, you guys asked for the full, and then I waited another month. So it was a lot of waiting, but it happened a lot quicker, it seems. But it was a lot of waiting. And then you guys asked again for the full, which freaked me out, because I thought, oh my God, they didn't get it the first time. Like, I almost blew my chance or something. But then they told me, no, it's just somebody asked for it and they didn't know we already had the full. And then I got a request from an e-publisher. They wanted to publish my book, and I was excited about that, but I thought, I really want to know if Angry Robot liked it. So you guys actually called the very next day after I got the the interest from the other publisher. Yeah. And I was like, this is meant to be, you know, I'm going with Angry Robot if they want it, you know, and everything seemed to really work out. But while I was waiting all that, I probably ended up submitting to about 9 agents and getting turned down. And then like 3 more turned me down. 3 more turned me down after I had the contract. And I'm like, okay, like, you know, you don't have to do any work. You just have to, you know, walk me through the contract thing. But then I found Amanda Rutter, and she's just amazing. So good things do come to those who wait.
Fantastic. And of course, I mean, it's like the eternal story in publishing is you're always hearing about the book that became a, you know, massive international globe conquering runaway success, but it was rejected by like 25 agents and 15 pitches before it found the one person who took a chance on it or who recognized some spark of what could be in it and just decided to give the author a go. And it just goes to show we don't really know what we're doing, maybe, when we're reading these submissions. It just takes the right person to recognize something, I guess, and recognize a story that will communicate something to other people. Well, it's fantastic to have such great stories about what goes into it. Both of you have had the long, interesting careers doing a variety of different things, but have you always been writers producing, you know, different pieces of fiction and nonfiction before writing the two manuscripts that have ultimately become your debut novels? Or did you come to fiction writing more recently?
I think I've always been a writer of some kind. When I was in middle school, you know, I was not the most diligent of students, but I found that I could make my grades better if I wrote a couple of emergency essays toward the end of the term. I thought I was kind of Andy Rooney at that time, you know, these wry kind of observations about the world and way it worked. And I started a couple of novels back when I was, you know, a kid. I think my first one I started when I was 13. It was called Triskaidekaphobia, which is the fear of the being 13. Mm-hmm. And then I, you know, went to college, and then I kind of stopped fiction writing in college, and I focused on nonfiction. And then I was a print journalist for about 11 years. And then I started teaching high school. And when I taught high school, I taught journalism and I also got creative writing. And I think teaching creative writing kind of opened that door again for me. So probably 10, 11, maybe 12 years ago, I started kind of getting serious about fiction and writing short stories and sending short stories out and novels and that kind of thing. So writing has always been part of my life, but the flavor has been different over the course of it.
Cool. So have you, through those different periods, so you said like you did fiction and you were focused more on the nonfiction while you were a print journalist and you came back to fiction. Mm-hmm. So has your writing tended to be either fiction or nonfiction at a time, or like even the past sort of decade or more where you've been doing more of the fiction stuff, have you still dabbled in the nonfiction pieces?
I still do a little nonfiction. I do some freelance journalism for an outfit here in New Hampshire. But not nearly as much. I find that it's hard to have it was hard for me at least to have a full-time writing job and write on the side.
For sure.
So it's been easier, it seems, to, you know, keep the nonfiction, the journalism on the side as kind of coffee money and focus on the fiction at this point in time.
Well, it's worked out well for you. And how about you, Ginger? Because funnily enough, I mean, we'll get to this in a little bit, but you've both been English teachers for a large part of your career. So has it been the same for you where the fiction writing has kind of accompanied that time of being a teacher, or is it something that's a more recent development for you?
I've always written fiction, I guess, since I was a kid. I think when I was 10 years old, I read a book and I hated the ending. And so I said, well, I can write my own book and it'll end how I want it to, you know, when I was about 10. And I wrote that book and, oh my God, all through middle school, I wrote on that book and it's horrible. I will have to burn it at some future time. But it was really cool to look back on. And I just pulled it out recently because I was talking to a group of kids for career day and telling them about, you know, my journey as a writer. And I saw where I had been trying to edit my piece. And I thought that was really cool because nobody ever taught me to do that at that point in time when I was 10. And so it kind of showed that was kind of an integral part of me. But I've been a freelance writer as well for newspapers. And, you know, I kind of went back and forth. I read a lot of nonfiction in college, of course, because as an English major, that's all you do. And then I think I went through a time where I didn't write anything just because I think I was exhausted after college. But becoming a teacher, you know, I had to get my feet under myself. And, you know, that takes up a lot of time. But about 2 years ago, a friend of mine who's an artist online, he told me, well, he wrote that he was going to create a piece of art a day. And I thought about that. And I said, you know what, if he can create a piece of art every day, I can write every day. So that's when I started writing about 2 hours a day, every day, without fail. And I think that's really what started me back on the writing journey. And, you know, I think the Russia's Edge kind of came out of that.
I like that you you hung on to your 10-year-old work.
I did.
I think that's, I wish I had some of my stuff from back then, but it's all kind of been lost to the ages. But it'd be interesting to kind of see who I was back when I was 8 or 9 or 10.
Right. It's painful to look at, yeah. But it's wonderful too to see that I had some of those qualities that, you know, that make us good writers today, you know, because editing is so important.
Right. And when you're famous, you know, or famouser, you can auction it off for charity.
Right. I don't know, though. Yeah. I don't know about that one. I might have to set that one on fire. But I did a lot of writing in high school, too, like in literary journals. We had a literary journal at my high school. And I have, you know, and probably about 8 years ago, I tried to write a fantasy novel and didn't get very far, but it's still in the archives. So maybe that will be in the future.
I had a terrible poetry career in high school. Aww. I kind of forget about it. But, you know, that I was writing a lot of poetry back then because I thought I had deep feelings.
So what form is this this early work in, Ginger? Is like, is it a single kind of typewritten manuscript or something, or is it like this weird cobbled together Frankenstein thing of different pieces written over different times, or what?
It's a novel. It probably reflects whatever book I was reading at the time, which you know, what do they say, you know, copying someone is the greatest form of flattery. You know, it's horrible. It was written in spiral bound notebooks, which I took out and put into this really ugly binder that I found somewhere, and it's all in there right now. And it's
written in longhand on like spiral notebook paper and then put in a plastic pocket folder.
Yeah, about in a regular binder, like a binder with like a three ring binder.
Right.
And it's
gotcha. Wow.
It's a Frankenstein. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, I think that's great. I really do.
300 pages.
My hat is off to your 10-year-old self.
I think if you've held on to it, that says that there's something in there, even if you even if you don't think it's very good, it's important.
Yeah. It's you. It's you captured.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great. So we've alluded to the fact that you're both teachers. Has teaching for you been that kind of feedback thing where you've learned something about the art of writing from the art of teaching it, teaching appreciation of books and teaching the art of reading a book in a certain way, or has it been a bit more detached than that?
Well, I think if anything, teaching something makes sure that you really know it. You know, you just get down deep and pull apart the structure of what people write in a way that you don't do when you just, you know, read something casually. I think that's one of the things that helped me, you know, with pacing a story. You know, when you read or teach different novels or stories over and over, like you do when you're a high school teacher, you really get a feel for the way an author puts all the parts of a narrative together. And I teach 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade English at my school. And I'm the only English teacher. So therefore, I'm the English department. So I teach a lot of things over and over every year. So I always see something new. You know, there's always a chance to see something new in a work.
So that gives you a lot of familiarity with a certain work. That, I mean, you've probably read, what a freshman read at your school?
Romeo and Juliet. We in 10th grade, we do Fahrenheit 451, which I dearly love. You know, that I always see something new in that work every time I teach it.
Yeah. So you have kind of the advantage of reading that over and over and over and over again until you really kind of understand it. Yeah, that's cool.
I've had kids point out things that I didn't notice in something. So, you know, I think there's always a chance to see something you never saw the first time.
I had I was Mr. Elective when I was teaching mostly. So I was doing journalism. I don't mind that. I mean, I did teach a little bit of English 1 and that kind of stuff, but mostly it was, you know, I taught creative writing. I taught journalism. I taught sci-fi literature. I taught.
Oh, wow. That would be great.
Yeah, it was fun. Expository writing and that kind of stuff. So I was I taught the quote unquote fun classes. But I made it a kind of a real point to make sure that I was writing with my students so they would know that it was also a process for me. So when they were critiquing stuff, they were also critiquing my stuff, you know, so I wanted to make sure that, you know, they understood that, you know, it's not one draft, it's, you know, it's multiple drafts and everything needs critique and all that kind of thing. So I think I share that with you. But also, like, I think the idea of kind of doing the same or similar assignments over again might have had kind of the same effect as really kind of drilling down into Fahrenheit 451 or something like that. As you get a chance to, like, you know, how can I do this differently? How can I look at this differently? How can I see this differently while still trying to do the same thing and get the desired effect, which is, you know, a classroom of kids who enjoys writing and who can write a short story.
Right.
Great. Yeah, fascinating kind of process. So when you talk about the critiquing, you mean that you would, is this like a round table kind of thing where you, does the class read through a single student's work together and then they all critique that student's work together? Or is it more like you swap pieces and each person comments on a single person's work?
No, we do the round table as much as we can, divide it into small groups. Wow. But I teach them, I taught them by giving them a piece of my own, and they read a piece of my own, and I kind of pretended to be someone else, and I had a student pretend to be me, so I could be the workshop facilitator as we went over the piece of my work as a whole class, and then we divided into smaller groups, and then they roundtabled on each other.
Wow.
So did the Light Years get critiqued by any of your students at some point, or some version of that manuscript?
I think it did. Pieces of it did. And I distinctly remember having a conversation with a couple of kids in the lunch line, because there's a bit in the Light Years written from the perspective of like a 6-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. And I was like trying to get them to read it and like, you know, does this sound like a kid? Does this sound like a kid would talk? So I definitely shared my work with them the entire time, but I'm trying to think if there's a specific piece. Some of there's the poetry in the book was actually written by students, because I had there's a couple of poems in there that are written from kind of the perspective of a teenager, kind of off camera. You never meet her, mm-hmm. but I wanted those to have a very different voice from anything else in the book. So I asked a couple of my kids to write some poetry for that, and they did, and they are acknowledged in the back of the book. So they're my students. Last night I had a reading in Nashua at the Toadstool Bookstore in Nashua. So I had a bunch of former students show up, from kids from 2007, 2008, and 2011. I told them that they were a big inspiration for kind of everything that went into that book. And it was quite nice to see them.
Wow.
That's fantastic that you still have the connection with those former students that many years on, and that mm-hmm. they would come along to support you. So yeah, wonderful. Well, hopefully you'll be able to do the same thing for them someday, maybe if they come to publish their own novels.
Oh, I hope so.
And did you ever share your writing with your students, Ginger, when they were learning about, or it sounds like being high school English, it does tend to be more focused on like essays and, right. and appreciating, you know, someone else's work. But if when they were doing like creative writing, did you ever sort of share your own work with them, or is it more of a detached process?
I didn't share any of the Russia's Edge with them, mm-hmm. But I do write. I do occasionally model for students and write side by side with them so that, you know, and I let them read mine, and then I read theirs, and we critique and do kind of the same stuff that Rob said. But yeah, I think writing my novel has been more of a detached thing. You know, it's sort of my escape from school. And plus also I teach kids who are sometimes lacking in a lot of abilities. So we kind of have to start at the basics. Mm-hmm. And so we spend a lot of time, you know, a lot of our kids are behind, and, you know, we're trying to catch them up as much as we can. But I do try to share narratives with them when we write our narratives, you know, and work on creative writing.
Cool. And I suppose one of the really good things about what you're doing with you being the English department, you must see the same students like when they're first starting out in freshman year and then going through, and then you're teaching them all the way through to senior year. Right. The ones who stick with it, you get to see them developing their enjoyment of literature and their capacities to appreciate it and write about it and write their own stuff. That must be really cool to see students go through that and know that you've kind of helped them along the way.
It is. You really do develop a bond with all the students, and I really get to know their writing style and how best to, you know, help them improve. We're a really small school, so we have about 50 kids in the high school.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's wow. tiny. It's the smallest public school in Georgia, I believe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So wow. it's really, really tiny. But, you know, I really do get to develop that bond with them. And the ones that are those writers, you know, I do everything I can to encourage them, you know, to develop their voice and what they have mm-hmm. to say about the world.
Well, that's great.
Cool.
Thank you for doing that work. I appreciate that.
Oh, well, thank you.
No, it's just, the kids are great. The kids are,
yeah,
these little clouds of potential. And it's just so great to, hear from someone who enjoys working with them and, really kind of values that. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much.
And you talk to anybody who's ended up in the creative world as like writer or artists or who've gone into filmmaking, you always talk to them and they talk about the impact of, everybody has that story about like someone who recognize something in them and help kind of fan the flames of what they saw and how important that is to developing your confidence in doing something that, as you say, like before you've done it, you don't necessarily know you can do it or that it's even something that's available to you as an option, as a form of creative output or certainly as a career option. So
right,
it's absolutely critical to have that support and inspiration and guidance, I guess. So we're not going to try to get into just like telling you how amazing you are, but you are doing a very important job and really doing it very well.
Well, they're great kids and they just need someone to listen to them and, help them through the forest of writing. They really get lost sometimes.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, it'll be a pretty cool moment, hopefully, when you can come into the classroom one day, if you want to do this, but you can show them the finished book, the cover and the binding, and you can point out it's in the bookstores and this is what you can do.
Right.
You stick with it.
Several of them, I mean, I've shared with them, the different things that have happened, when the book got when I was able to sell the book and I've talked to them about the publishing journey. And so they know what's going on. They've asked me to read parts of it to them, but I'm kind of waiting on a good time, I guess. And, I do want to share that with them though. I really do. Yeah.
Hopefully you'll have a reading in your town there.
Yes.
So you can open them all out to it because that'd be, it's a good reason for a reunion if nothing else.
Right. For sure.
Absolutely. I don't know if you've seen, Ginger, the pictures that Rob's been putting up of his launch events.
Yes. But,
you had a really spectacular cake for your launch party last week, Rob, which everyone in the office was very jealous of.
I've been watching that. Rob, it looks like you're having the time of your life. It really does.
It's been a good time. Yeah, we'll die.
And you've got a few more events coming up, actually, so I'll make sure that we stick a link in the podcast episode so that any New Hampshire locals or anyone else who happens to be in the path of your tour and your events can come along and say hello and see what it's all about.
Great.
So both your books feature some pretty high SF concepts and very well thought out ideas. In the case of the light years, it's all the faster than light travel and the notion of relativistic time. And Ginger, in yours, you've got genetically modified super soldiers. Did you guys do any research into these concepts behind the books when you were formulating them, or did you more go into them just with the mindset that you're a novelist, it's not hard sci-fi, you can just conjure it up and create it in whatever way you want? Or, if that was the case, was there any sort of particular fictional inspirations, whether in the form of books or film or TV or whatever, that helped you out with formulating those sorts of elements of the book?
Actually, the story behind that is kind of weird. I did start from more of a soft sci-fi point of view. But I guess the super soldier idea has been around a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Captain America, Jason Bourne. In Brave New World, there's a lot about genetic engineering that I found fascinating.
For sure, yeah.
And that's probably what inspired me in a lot of ways to create the VATS. And another inspiration was thinking about kids who have ADHD and how hyper they are. And I thought, how could you turn that into a positive, And that kind of all came together somehow in my brain. To help me create the VAT. They're like a whole group of people who have no family ties, because they were genetically enhanced and grown in artificial wombs and implanted with nanites to allow them to use the rush. And the rush in my book is kind of like, I'm trying to think of how to explain it. It's like the VATs are able to tap into the highest fringes of human potential through this adrenaline rush that they're modified to have. And it allows them to do incredible things that regular people can't do. But they're also programmed to believe anything that they're told by their superiors. And so I set all that up, thought about that, and all that kind of gelled in my mind. But after I wrote the book, I actually ran into a Popular Mechanics article that talked about Russia and China having what they call enhanced human operations programs. Mm-hmm. And it says that these are theoretical, and I guess, I don't know if they've done some of these things, but to create super soldiers. And so I read this article, and as I'm reading it, like everything that I did with the VATS was kind of in this article. It talked about drugs and vaccines to boost the soldier's ability to get the job done, you know, and reduce pain, mm-hmm. and anti-sleep drugs and brain implants. And all of this was in this article. And I'm like, wow, you know, that's really interesting that I just kind of came up with it, but then they're really doing stuff like this, or they're, at least they're planning on that, or they have that,
yeah,
you know, in the theoretical stages. So I did come at it from a soft sci-fi point of view, but I don't know, maybe some of this stuff can really happen one day.
Mm-hmm.
So you thought you were writing sci-fi, but it turns out you've been writing contemporary fiction.
Yes. And, you know, recently that show Treadstone had come out, and mm-hmm. that some of that I was like, wow, I really liked it, because, you know, it was after I read the book, of course, but I really thought, wow, that's what I was going for. You know, that kind of a, what happens to soldiers like this after they've been in war? You know, where do they go after that? That's kind of what I focused on, a little less of the super soldier thing. Well, I'm trying to think how I'm going to explain that.
Yeah, because the book's all set like after he's come out of the service, because he has been sort of discharged. But it's not a good thing that they've been supercharged and genetically modified. The downside is that they age more quickly, isn't it?
Right.
And that every time they go through the rush, it pushes them closer to the point of burning out.
Right.
So we're meeting the character after he's been ejected from the service, and he's an ex that, but he still has this genetic programming that means that he's suffering the downsides of it. So
yeah.
It's one of those great sci-fi concepts where this is who he's been and this is what he's done, but now he's having to deal with the rough aftermath of that when he's forgotten about by the people who did that to him.
Right.
Which just makes for, you know, a fascinating character study and a great starting point for the novel.
Right. And you just said all that beautifully. You know, I wanted to like follow his struggle. Like,
yeah.
You know, my dad was a Vietnam veteran. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just kind of thought, what happens to soldiers when they come back? You know, and I did do a little investigation into that, you know, research for the book. And that's exactly right. It's what happens to him after the service that mm-hmm. that is important. That's where I felt like the story began. And also his struggle to deal with his VAT side, you know, his abilities to like deal with that and try to have a regular life is very hard for him.
Yeah, but you've got his best friend, who's his former CEO, who has found this life for him where they are out on the edge salvaging messed up spaceships that they find, and he's kind of trying to find a way to help him work through that almost trauma from no longer being a soldier, and to find a way to live in a productive, satisfying way that is doing something other than doing what he was programmed for.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a really great analogy for that post-Vietnam, post-Iraq, post,
right.
It's kind of that eternal thing of like the soldier who returns from war and what do they do next?
Right.
Well, we're seeing a lot of that now too. You know, we've been at war. America's been at war for, you know, going on 20 years now. And
right.
We're seeing,
of course,
yeah, a lot of these soldiers, these kids coming back, and they're damaged. You know, they have a hard time finding their place, and, you know, PTSD and
right.
head injuries and all kinds of things. So I imagine you've probably seen, you know, some of your kids come back that way. You know, I know I have. And
yeah.
So it's a very timely book.
Well, and, you know, I like to focus on relationships, too, between characters. And he's very, if he didn't have this commanding officer to focus him, I think, you know, he would have ended up in a much rougher place. So that connection that they have together, I think, allowed him to maybe adjust a little bit better to life on the outside of the military in the story.
Well, it's a lot of really interesting, fascinating elements for people to get into when they can finally get their hands on it.
Yeah.
And how about you, Rob? What research did you do for The Light Years?
I did a panel at Worldcon Dublin back in the fall called Can Bad Science Lead to Good Science Fiction or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's kind of one of the downsides of writing space opera or space sci-fi, is that there's so little evidence that we're actually ever going to be able to achieve warp speed or faster than light travel or anything like that. But I, I did some research. There's a book series that Ben Bova edited, a science fiction writing series, and that came out in like in the 90s. And I got the space travel one out, and I looked at all the possible means of faster than light travel and came up with the one that's the least likely or most likely to actually work, which is wormholes. And then I started looking at wormholes and, you know, and it turns out we actually have created a wormhole, an artificial wormhole, and it's very, very tiny. And it's only been able to transmit magnetic waves. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that was enough for me.
Right. It's theoretically possible. We can do this thing.
Theoretically possible. So that's the one I went with the wormhole creation. So that's kind of the science research I did. And a lot of the other ones was just kind of looking at kind of the cultural, you know, looking at, because there's kind of a strong refugee feel to the book.
Absolutely, yeah.
And looking at kind of what happens when you have to flee your home and what you leave behind and what gets lost either on purpose or an accident and, you know, what you're trying to put together again on the other end of your trip. So I read a lot of kind of news about that, and I'm a big reader anyway, so I'm always reading something. So probably everything that I've ever read about that refugee experience showed up in this book in some way, shape, or form.
Wow.
So yeah, and I think people who don't read sci-fi, and it's that kind of eternal debate between literary fiction or commercial fiction and so-called genre fiction, is this idea that, oh, it's just about spaceships and aliens and ray guns and it doesn't engage with the real world. But you've both, you know, in sort of 5 minutes, given really great examples of how your own work, which at first description might sound like they are in that fantasist, it's about escapism, but it's engaging with real world issues that, you know, the readers will have, if not experienced themselves, then certainly read about and thought about. And it's giving you a lens and a framework through which to explore that in a really interesting way. And through, those sort of fascinating concepts. And your book is all about economic differences between people. And you've got the arranged marriage element in there. And yeah, it's amazing how many different elements you've kind of neatly knitted together. And of course you've got that great structure where you're going back and forth between the perspectives of two characters, so you can see the same issues and the same relationship from two different sides, which is a really cool thing to experience as a reader.
Well, sci-fi does this really kind of cool thing, and I was just talking to this with somebody recently. Have either of you read Bloodchild, the Octavia Butler story?
No.
I've not.
I have not.
You should. Okay. But I use it in, I've used it in a bunch of different classes, most recently at the sophomore seminar over at this university I teach at. And it's a story. It's about, you know, far future, this bunch of Terrans have fled the planet for political persecution, and they're refugees, and they've come to this new place, and they've, you know, achieved this kind of symbiotic relationship with the native species there. But by kind of looking at that story, and looking at it as a story, I can teach that in a class who, you know, some of them are blue state people and some of them are red state people and some of them wear the red MAGA hat and some of them, you know, are voting for Bernie Sanders. And we can to talk about that story and talk about the issues behind that story without pissing too many people off, you know. So in it, you know, it harkens back to the whole idea of putting kids in cages and, you know, putting up the wall and that kind of stuff. But because we've kind of taken it out to the future with aliens and space travel and that kind of stuff, we can actually have a conversation about the issues behind the story without getting everybody in a bad mood.
So you find that students are much more willing to engage with and discuss that than they might be if you just said, is it right or wrong to do X and Y that this political party is doing or that political party is arguing for?
Very much so, yeah.
I think sci-fi has always done that. It, you know, taking a contemporary issue and examined it from another viewpoint, you know, outside of, you know, our world. What if we set it in another world? I mean, Star Trek did that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've been rewatching like a few bits of, you know, the original series and The Next Generation recently. And it's amazing how groundbreaking the original series was in terms of the representation of actors of color.
Right.
I think the first ever interracial kiss, I think, was on an episode of Star Trek. And
yep.
Sometimes it was very clumsy. There was an episode where people who have like one half of their face white and the other half black and the other race is the opposite. Mm-hmm. So it's not the most kind of subtle, you know, analog for real world issues, but, you know, full credit for trying it out. Of course, Fahrenheit 451 is a great example as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of earlier sci-fi kind of did it in a less dexterous way. You know, they didn't, you know, they do, mm-hmm. they are a little clumsy, as you say.
But no less fun or readable for that.
Exactly. Yeah.
I love that kind of stuff. I like it when it's a little, I don't know. It's a little, it's like watching a cheesy sci-fi movie, you know, it's a little mm-hmm. cheesy, but you still love it.
You like the brain in the jar?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, everybody likes a good brain in the jar story.
Yeah.
So what were the kind of formative books for both of you when you were first getting into sci-fi? I presume for both of you, like as kids, it kind of grabbed your attention maybe in some way. But so what were the books you read growing up that first introduced you to what sci-fi could do, and maybe what's a bit of stuff that you've read more recently that you enjoy?
I'm trying to think. I think, you know, my dad took me to see the first Star Wars movie when it came out in 77. I was six. And I think I was probably hooked mm-hmm. right after that.
Yes.
But I've always been a huge, huge, huge reader. You know, I read voraciously. The library was my favorite babysitter. I've also read really broadly. So when I wasn't reading sci-fi, I was reading Trixie Belden novels because, you know, I like Trixie Belden. She was always solving crimes with her friends and building clubhouses and that kind of stuff. And, you know, as I got, you know, older and, you know, quote unquote, more sophisticated, I think my dad gave me 1984 and I read 1984 and kind of really started seeing the possibilities of kind of socioeconomic political sci-fi. Mm-hmm. So from 1984 to, you know, some of the good Heinlein stuff to, you know, the Foundation series, the Asimov did to, you know, the robot stuff to,
yeah.
you know, modern day, which is when it's getting really, really exciting because of all the translations and all the sci-fi work that's coming from other parts of the world. One of my favorite books that I've read in the last couple of years is Frankenstein in Baghdad. Which is an Iraqi sci-fi mm-hmm. Translated, and I can't recall who the author is right now, but it's like, you know, it's just a voice talking about the same kind of issues coming from a place that I've never heard a voice coming from before. You know, there's a lot of really good translated Chinese sci-fi coming that I can now read. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of good Nigerian sci-fi that's coming. You know, Tay Thompson with the Rosewater series that he's just kind of finished up. He was born in Nigeria, but now lives in London. Mm-hmm. But there's just so much good stuff out there now that I have. It's almost depressing because I know I will never live long enough to read it all.
Yeah, the eternal struggle of actually choosing what to read. And there's yeah. so much good stuff that you can't even read all the good stuff, let alone the stuff that's less good.
Exactly, right. Exactly.
How about you, Ginger? What were the kind of those formative works for you, or the things that really kind of grabbed you early on?
When I was a kid, I have to say mine goes back to my dad too. He was a huge sci-fi fan. And growing up, he had just giant stacks of books everywhere of like, little paperbacks of Andre Norton's works or Heinlein. I read all that stuff when I was a kid, and I can't say I understood all of it, but I think it just fueled that desire, you know, to read more sci-fi. And when I got older and just really got into Star Wars when I was younger, and that kind of led into my other reading when I got older. But, you know, 1984 was really big, like Rob said, and Brave New World mm-hmm. and, you know, I love Ray Bradbury. I'm a huge Ray Bradbury fan. I have a lot of his like original paperbacks, you know, the ones that were released back in the day. So
yeah.
I'm just a big Ray Bradbury fan. And Rod Serling, I love his work. He didn't just do The Twilight Zone. He also wrote as well a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I just think I've probably been more influenced by TV shows and movies than reading, because I have to be so selective in what I read. I don't have a lot of time left after
for sure.
the whole school day and, you know, grading sure, papers. Yeah. And I try to read what I can, but I have to, you know, kind of be selective these days, because when I'm reading, I'm not writing. I have to really choose, you know, the quality stuff like Rob said.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Actually, on that, do you remember the book you mentioned that was kind of the inspiration for you to start writing, the one that where you didn't like the ending? Do you remember what story that was?
I do. It was when I was a kid, my dad had read the Shannara series by Terry Brooks.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
And it was the second one in that trilogy. Like the Elf Stones of Shannara, which yeah, you know, yeah. I for like a little 10-year-old, 12-year-old girl, it was kind of interesting, but that was the one that really got me angry, I guess.
That's awesome.
You know, one of my favorite characters died or whatever, and I said, well, I'm gonna write my own.
You were a great kid.
Well, that'll be the goal for you to continue the writing career and to do that to someone else. You'll want them to get so invested in the character that when you do yes. something terrible to them, it'll inspire them to pick up the pen. And,
yes.
Except for these days, fan fiction, they might send you the redone ending.
Right. But I think that's awesome. Great. You know.
Yeah. That's so cool.
No, that would be really cool.
Yeah.
So obviously you guys will probably have massive collections of books
yes.
all over your house and everything else. But I understand you have some other collections as well. Rob, you collect typewriters, I believe, and you wrote mm-hmm. a really interesting piece for, is it Mary Robinette's mm-hmm. blog the other yep. day? Or was it John Scalzi's?
Mary Robinette.
Mary Robinette, yeah. About that collection. And Ginger, you've got a few different collections. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what those collections are and how you first got into collecting maybe?
Oh, yeah, sure. I'll be glad to. I guess I got involved with collecting because my husband collects comic books, and helping him mm-hmm. find different, you know, pieces that he needed for his collection. We went to a lot of comic conventions and we kept seeing Gold Key comics, and I got really into Bronze and Silver Age comics that had to do with Gold Key. And Gold Key did Twilight Zones, Ripley's Believe It or Not, Boris Karloff. So I'm getting a big collection of those. I'm still working on all of them, but we kept seeing vintage toys. So we started collecting vintage toys, and we have a pretty big collection now. Like all the $6 million Mans, we have every type of Steve Austin that they put out.
Do you have the Bigfoot?
We do. We have Bigfoot in the box.
Fantastic.
Which I hear is like, that is the ultimate, to have Bigfoot yep. in the box.
Bigfoot in the box.
That was amazing. We have that one. Let's see. We have a lot of Mego figures, Star Trek figures, Planet of the mm-hmm. Apes figures. My favorite piece, though, is probably this really rare retro Star Trek poster from the 70s. And we had that, and we got it signed by the artist, Jim Strinko. Mm-hmm. And we saw him at a con, and seeing him sign it was really cool. Because we walk up and there's this older guy, and he's wearing a medallion and a black turtleneck, and he just looks so retro fabulous, you know. It mm-hmm. it was really cool to meet him and have him sign that, and so that's in our living room, and that's one of my favorite pieces, I think. Yeah, and really it's like a giant scavenger hunt for me, and you know, like one time we went to this toy con in Atlanta. And my husband was collecting G.I. Joe stuff at that time. And there was the Mercury capsule that G.I. Joe goes in, and he has a whole space suit. And I couldn't find the other glove. And I found one glove at one dealer and went to another dealer. I went through these big bins, and I was looking for this glove. And then finally I found it, and it was like the best feeling ever.
That's amazing. How small is the glove? It must be like G.I. Joe's hand is pretty small.
Oh, yeah, it's tiny. I mean, you go through all these little socks and little shoes and pants and wow. shirts. And so you have to look for this one thing. And, you know.
You don't want two lefts or two rights. You got to get a left and right. A right.
No, exactly. I was going to say.
We went searching for Oscar Goldman's outfit from the $6 Million Man. And that was a big search. We had to find his socks and his shoes. And so I think we found two socks at one guy's place, and we found the shoes somewhere else. And for a while he just had his jacket, and then we found the shirt, you know. So it's amazing, like, what the details that go into that. But I'm very detail oriented. Yeah. So that was fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really cool that you've cobbled them together, because I just assumed that you'd be finding all these things in like one piece, but you're literally digging into a box of random costumes.
Yes.
Assorted action figures, and then you just find the right. Wow, you're like, that's amazing.
Oh, this looks like Oscar Goldman's shoe. And, you know, you have to know what that stuff looks like and find it. It's a whole community yeah. of people, so yeah. it's a lot of fun to put that stuff together. And like I said, it's like a giant scavenger hunt.
Yeah, that's and every great. Time you see Steve Austin there in his spacesuit, you can look at that glove that you found. And you know that all the effort went into finding that glove.
Right, I found it. It's like that's amazing. Yeah, it's like buried treasure for sure.
Yeah, that's too funny. That's too awesome.
And your collection, Rob, is the objects are slightly easier to find. You don't have to dig through giant boxes of them.
No, that's very true. That's very true. I mean, I had a comic book collection from the 90s too, but I haven't done anything with it in a long time. But mm-hmm. no, the reason I started collecting typewriters is I didn't have enough computers in my classroom for all my kids to have keyboards. So I started thinking, well, how can I get enough kids practicing on keyboards and learning how to write and that kind of stuff? And I started picking up typewriters at lawn sales for like $5 and $10 and that kind of stuff. And eventually I had amassed a bunch of them, and they were all hanging out in my classroom, and I had to learn how to kind of fix them and repair them and maintain them and that kind of stuff in order to keep them running. So eventually I had, you know, 40 some odd typewriters, knowing that I can only write on one at a time myself, but it, you know, it kind of became a hobby, and you have to learn a lot about the different types and where they come from, and, you know, the years they came out and the parts and that kind of stuff. So, And there's a scavenger hunt, and there is a big typewriter collecting community online that, you know, I became part of, and, you know, that led to this and led to that. And my wife, Brenda, is an artist, and she did a photography calendar of the typewriters, which became a gallery show of the typewriters. Wow. So, you know, the whole thing has kind of, you know, gone further and crazier than I ever expected. But I also do a fair amount of writing on them. I wrote the light years on a typewriter because I find it a lot easier to get in the zone than on a computer, because kind of like Ginger was saying, there's only so much time. And if I, you know, get on a laptop, I might say, well, I'm going to check my email, or I'm going to check Twitter first. And by the time I've done that, I've eaten up half my writing time.
Yes.
But if I have a typewriter, then, you know, the whole hour of my writing time is kind of dedicated to writing. So I find that kind of an easier way to kind of get and stay within the zone. Then I scan it, and then I upload it into Google Docs, and Google Docs turns it into a editable text file. And then I can do the second draft and the third draft and so on with the computer.
Wow.
That's like the absolute best of both worlds. Like, you've really found a good way to combine the old and the new there.
Yeah, it works out pretty good. And, you know, they make good sounds. And, you know, like, I was listening to Ginger talking about kids with ADHD, and I find that, you know, kids who have ADHD, they do pretty well on typewriters, actually.
I bet they do.
It's kinesthetic and, you know, makes noise and, you know, it's hard to get distracted by them. So it's still kind of a, you know, even though the last good one was probably made 30, 40 years ago, I think they still have a place in the classroom.
I mean, I've got a friend who's a writer, and she does all her writing on a laptop, but she downloaded an app where every keystroke makes a typewriter noise. And when you push enter to go next line, it does the ding noise.
Yeah.
And
for the same reason, it just the feedback thing, it just somehow focuses you more. And maybe you pay more attention to the fact that you're just faffing around on Twitter when every time you type a tweet, it makes typewriter noises. And makes you think, I shouldn't be doing this. This doesn't seem right.
Right.
So it's her way of focusing herself when she's trying to write something.
That makes sense.
Yeah, cool. Well, one last question. So obviously both your books deal with spaceships and space travel. And we seem to be, I mean, this is the eternal thing, isn't it? It's like the flying car. We always seem to be on the cusp of commercial space travel, even if just like going up into low orbit or something being something that's available for us. So I want to ask you, if the opportunity were there to do, let's say, a short trip, if you're not traveling interstellarly, you're not traveling faster than light, you're just going to do a short hop to, let's say, Mars. Let's say Mars will take you 6 months to go to, and then you can come back at the end of it. Would you jump at the chance to do some space travel if you could? And if you were to say yes, what book, film, and what was the other thing I was going to do? Book, film, and...
Album.
Yeah. There we go. Because, of course, Ginger used to work at a record store, so you must be a big music buff as well.
Yes.
Yeah, if you were going to do a six-month trip to Mars in a spaceship, you get one book, you get one movie, and you get one album. What would you pick?
That's hard. I know I would go, because my husband would go. The book. Lord of the Rings, maybe? I have a book edition that has all three in one book, so maybe I could cheat and take that one with me.
Omnibuses totally count, that you have an omnibus.
Okay, cool. And then I guess for movie, probably, I had trouble with that one. I was thinking about that. Probably Star Wars, A New Hope. I might take that one. And the album, I guess I would take, right now I've been listening to a lot of Pink Floyd. So Wish You Were Here by Pink Floyd.
That's a good choice. I like that.
Yeah.
That's a good
choice. Very good choices.
Even if it was a one-way trip, I think I would go. The Mars Foundation was like doing things. And, you know, the only reason I didn't sign up for the Mars Foundation is my spouse would not come with me. She doesn't like the idea of being cramped up in a spaceship for 3 months or 6 months and maybe never coming back.
Fair enough. It's hard to argue in some respects.
Yeah, it's hard to argue. You know, it kind of makes sense. But no, I would definitely go on that two-way trip, but I would also take the one-way trip, provided she would go with me.
Oh.
Let's see. Let me think about this. One book, one film, and one album. When I think about the film that I kind of return to, or that I watch every single time it shows up on TV, would be Roadhouse, the Patrick Swayze vehicle.
Amazing choice.
Yeah, I like Roadhouse. Pain Don't Hurt, and some good lessons there about, you know, be nice until it's time to not be nice.
Mm-hmm.
The book, that's more difficult. I mean, I think I have a Kindle, so I have have many books on my Kindle.
You can have an omnibus, but Kindle's cheating.
Kindle is cheating. Ah, man. Could I have a, even though there's an omnibus that has not been made, can I get a omnibus made of William Gibson's Sprawl trilogy?
Yeah, you can have a series. We can pretend you can stick them together.
Yeah, I'll duct tape them together, and that'll be the William Gibson's Sprawl trilogy. Album wise, I'd go for, you know, it's always good to go for like the White Album, the Beatles White Album,
because
it's set and they, you know, they're all doing their kind of thing on it.
Yes.
But I'm also really into hip hop, so I feel like I might take Pimp the Butterfly.
Amazing. By Kendrick Lamar.
I think that might be the way I go. Because I love that, love that album. I can listen to that over and over again, and I can find new things in that. So that might be the one that I bring.
I think those three would keep you entertained for quite a while.
Yeah, I think so.
Cool. All right. Well, we'll be sure to pass along the invitation to you if Elon Musk ever gets in touch to ask us to send some authors.
Excellent.
Yay. I'll go.
I have a theory. You guys know about the car he launched into space? You heard about this? Yeah, because Elon Musk launched his Tesla into space, and I was thinking how what a good way that would be to get rid of a body. You know, because
I just had a story idea because
there's a space-suited figure in it, right? So, and you can like watch the camera and see the space-suited figure. So that's one body in the spacesuit, and then the Tesla's got a trunk, so you can throw at least two more in there. So, if you wanted to get rid of three bodies with no chance of they've ever been found, you put them in a car, you launch the car into space. That's my theory.
I feel like that's as far as ways of getting rid of bodies go, that's quite an expensive method.
But if you're Elon Musk and you launch a car into space anyway, why not?
Okay. So if any of Michael Bloomberg's enemies go missing or something, we should look into space and see if there's any new space junk floating around.
Exactly. Okay.
Well, that took a delightfully macabre turn at the end there, which is a great way to finish off. Thank you for that contribution, Rob. And thank you both of you for your wonderful contributions today. Thank you for telling us about your fantastic books and your fascinating careers and your wonderful collections as well. Thanks on behalf of the Angry Robot team to both Rob Green and Ginger Smith for joining us to talk about the light years and the Rush's Edge. We'll put some links down below the podcast listing so you can check out all the books and films and albums that they've talked about and follow those links yourselves. So just falls to me to say thank you, Rob. Thank you, Ginger. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Sam. Ginger, wonderful to meet you.
It was wonderful to meet you, and thanks for having us.
No worries. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.